semblance of due process. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, who was appointed by President Reagan, headed up that three-judge panel. He noted that the Justice Department had already admitted it deported Brego Garcia mistakenly and asked, quote, why then should it not make what was wrong right? Earlier this week, a judge had ruled Abrego Garcia's lawyers should be able to question administration officials, but the Department of Justice argues that that was untenable and said the government had no powers to return Abrego Garcia. But with this latest ruling, they have lost that argument, so now officials must explain what they're doing, if anything, to bring him back, or they could appeal again, this time to the Supreme Court.
And what did the court say about the administration's refusal to comply with these orders?
Yeah, so Judge Wilkinson said this is a slippery slope. In his order, he imagined a future in which there would be no assurances that the executive branch would not deport American citizens or train its powers on political enemies. He said we're in a moment where the executive and judicial branches are close to grinding irrevocably against one another in a conflict that promises to diminish both. But he also said there is an opportunity here, saying, quote, we yet cling to the hope that it is not naive to believe our good brethren in the executive branch perceive the rule of law as vital to the American ethos. This ruling follows a decision from U.S. District Judge James Boasberg earlier this week, where he said he might hold Trump officials in contempt for disregarding his order to stop sending deportees to that same Salvadoran prison.
That's NPR's Ryland Barton. Thank you, Ryland.
Thank you.
President Trump is trying to pressure the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates, which it's reluctant to do because of tariffs. And after Fed Chair Jerome Powell warned that Trump's tariff policies could make it harder to limit inflation, the president posted on social media yesterday that Powell's termination, quote, cannot come fast enough. To talk this through, we're joined by Peter Conti Brown. He's a financial historian and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Peter, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So does the president have the legal authority to fire Powell before his term expires in May of next year?
You know, last time we had almost exactly this conversation in the first Trump administration, the answer was much clearer that the president did not. But in the last few months in the second Trump administration, the president has made an assault on the independence of administrative agencies a keystone of his legal strategy. And those very questions, which are currently being litigated, could determine the answer to that question. It's much more uncertain today than it was in, say, 2018.
What makes it more uncertain? I mean, Trump has fired, as you point out, members of independent agencies since taking office, and the Supreme Court sided with him in a case related to two of those firings earlier this month. Is that what is making this moment uncertain?
That's the big part of it. The Supreme Court and the Trump administration itself have said, kind of hinted, that the Fed might be different. But as I sit here today as both a historian and as a legal scholar, I read the statutes and they have exactly, nearly word for word, the same protections at the Federal Trade Commission, for example, as the Federal Reserve. So if those protections go away because the Supreme Court writes them away, then the independence of the Federal Reserve is much more fragile than it was before.
Why is the Fed's independence important? And is Trump's attempt to pressure it its actions unique to a president?
The independence of the Federal Reserve stands for the idea that all politicians are going to want to goose the economy in the short term because that makes their voters and their constituents happy. And that's a bipartisan enthusiasm. In that sense, President Trump is not unique. Nearly every president has wanted the Fed to be more accommodating to their policies. But we don't want a short-term sugar rush of stimulus in the economy. And so Congress designed the central bank to have its eye on the long-term ball. We want stability. We want growth without inflation. And so the independence of the Federal Reserve is to create that kind of scenario. What's unique about President Trump is his wide assertions to delegitimize that very independence. And that's the thing, as I say here today, that I fear the most.
You say you fear that. What happens if it comes to fruition?
If people don't trust the Federal Reserve to keep their eye on that long-term ball, if they believe President Trump that it's just political hacks operating monetary policy and doing so incompetently, then their ability to plan, to trust in these institutions, to put their confidence in the economy for the future will upend everything about that we understand about economic growth and about where we're going as an economy.
Yesterday, Politico reported that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has warned the White House that firing Powell could destabilize financial markets. Is he correct?
He's absolutely right. The destabilization we've seen in the bond markets, for example, in reaction to the tariff policy, would be like a child's soccer game compared to the World Cup of destabilization if we lose Fed independence. Fed independence is the bulwark of stability for the bond market, for our capital markets, for the U.S. dollar. If that goes away, well, we know this story. We've seen economies like this in Turkey and Lebanon and Venezuela and so many other places. The Fed's independence keeps us from that chaos.
I mean, you're describing economies that have failed, that have tanked. I mean, is that possible in the U.S.?
That is not something that I would have said yes to even many months ago, but I would say that it is possible today, yes.
Trump allies argue that the president should have more authority over independent agencies. They exist under the executive branch. What are your thoughts on that argument?
I think the idea of independence is a bit of a red herring. The Federal Reserve is not independent. It's insulated. The president has enormous power to influence the direction of the Fed. And that comes when Jay Powell's term ends 1 year from now and he gets to select the next Fed chair. But it shouldn't come before.
Peter Conti Brown is a financial historian at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. will walk away from efforts to broker a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine if progress isn't made within days. Rubio spoke a day after a new peace push in Paris, organized by French President Emmanuel Macron, that for the first time included European allies. Here's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley.
After 2 months of direct talks with Russian President Vladimir Putin went nowhere, the Trump administration seemed willing to give the European initiative a shot, sending its top three diplomats to Paris. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio and White House envoys Steve Witkoff and Keith Kellogg sat down with French President Emmanuel Macron and envoys from the U.K., Germany, and Ukraine. It was the highest level of transatlantic engagement on the conflict since February. Macron said the meeting had been productive and that talks would continue in London next week. But leaving Paris this morning, Rubio said things had to happen in a matter of days, not weeks.
If it's not possible, if we're so far apart that this is not going to happen, then I think the president's probably at a point where he's going to say, well, we're done.
That comes as no surprise to Ukraine expert Nicholas Tenzer, who says Europe has different priorities than those of the White House.
To find a deal with Putin, Russia, and then basically to turn to other matters, namely China, Asia, etc. And then he wants basically to get rid of this issue, even if it means a kind of full surrender to Putin.
He says for the Europeans, the defense of Ukraine and survival of the Ukrainian nation is a priority in itself and key to European security. Tenzer says whatever the U.S. decides, the Europeans will continue to arm and support Ukraine. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:19. Happy to have you with us on this Friday. And because it's a Friday, Wisconsin Life is, of course, coming up later this hour. In about 25 minutes, we're going to hear a story about connecting with nature just as spring starts to emerge. Of course, the warm temperatures mixing with those cool temperatures mean rain for a whole lot of Wisconsin today. We'll get the details on that in just a few minutes on WPR.
Hey, it's Scott Detrow. I'm so happy to be the new weekend host of All Things Considered, where we dive into the week's biggest headlines, plus environmental stories.
Freshwater is like, I don't want to sink. I'm very light. I don't want to sink.
Culture.
You have to celebrate food. You have to celebrate life, you know, and food and life go together.
And so much more. Celebrate your weekends with All Things Considered.
Saturday afternoon at 4 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from HGA, a national multidisciplinary design firm rooted in architecture and engineering, committed to creating energy-efficient buildings, including hospitals and offices. HGA.com.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Racine's Festival Park is offering a risk-free fundraising program for local schools and nonprofits. To learn more, go to festivalpark.com/fundraising or contact Rebecca at 262-636-9229.
Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. High temperatures expected in the 50s and 60s today. Right now we've got some rain on the eastern half of the state. That should be clearing later on. Overnight, we'll see low temperatures in the 30s and 40s, staying relatively dry. Mix of sunshine and clouds tomorrow. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Fisher Investments. Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Total Wine & More, for discovering something new, like a Cabernet or single-barrel bourbon, learn more at totalwine.com. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina, available to adults 21 or older. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez.
Who is it?
It's me, Dave. Open up, man. I got the stuff.
In the 1970s, Cheech and Chong were the OGs of pot humor.
Dave?
Yeah, Dave. Come on, man. Open up. I think the cops
Dave's
saw me.
Dave's not here.
No, man. I'm Dave, man.
Their albums hit the top 10. Their live shows sold out. Their movie screenings were jam-packed with fans, though I have no idea how they saw the screen through the haze. There's a new documentary about their partnership. It's called Cheech and Chong's Last Movie. Now, here's one thing I learned. Before he met Cheech, Tommy Chong was in a band signed to Motown Records.
I had a family-owned nightclub in Vancouver, Canada, and the house band. We never had a name, but we had a house band, and we had a great singer named Bobby Taylor. And Diana Ross and the Supremes came and heard Bobby sing. So she phoned Berry Gordy, and Berry Gordy literally flew the next day. He signed us, he loved us, signed us. I got fired from Motown.
They found out he was Chinese.
It was in that nightclub that Tommy Chong first met Cheech Marin in 1969. Cheech grew up in L.A., but went to Vancouver to learn pottery and to avoid getting drafted for the Vietnam War. The two started performing comedy together, then made their way to L.A. to hone their act. As they got bigger, they got to shoot their first film on a shoestring budget. Up in Smoke became a cult smash in 1978.
You know, like I smoked that Michoacan, man, Acapulco Gold, man. I even smoked that tight stick, you know?
Tight stick?
Yeah, you know, that stuff is tied to a stick, you know?
Tight stick.
So my mom would not let me watch your stuff.
That's a wise mom.
She was afraid. No, she was afraid that I would start smoking pot. But did you ever come up with, like, later on with people's like, I always wanted to see what you did, but I was always not allowed to see what you did.
All the time. We heard that story all the time. And it's always with the fathers that come in, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You can't do this. And they became the biggest fans. It was never the moms. It was always the dads.
Did you guys ever think, like, this association with marijuana, because at the time it's illegal taboo, did you ever think that that eventually might be something that would harm you at some point?
No, we never really thought about it because we were reflecting the culture that was around us at the time. And we did a survey of all the material we did at both on stage and on records, and it was only 5% of anything we did. Hmm. But it was the biggest image that came up in everybody's mind as soon as they first heard about us or saw us.
But even, Cheech, you came to a point where you wanted to do something not related to marijuana, right?
Yeah, yeah. Then we were getting pegged over there just about marijuana and blah, 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 blah.
Well, that was our secret sauce with the studios. And so we got a movie called the Corsican Brothers. Cheech and I decided that no pot in this one. You know, this is our chance.
Because they hadn't invented pot.
They hadn't invented pot.
And so I directed it and wrote it. And the studio, they weren't too happy. The suit that was assigned to the movie, she kept trying to get us to put pot in the movie.
Well, your films, like in the video store, like when they actually had the videotapes, right? It was almost like your films, you know, in the bookstore where you have like the X-rated magazines.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
Oh, you always felt like you're kind of looking around to see who's watching you grab Up in Smoke or grab next movie. It almost felt like I had to like grab it and stick it in my coat and walk.
That was like an advertising dream. Hmm. You know, if you got something that's taboo, it's called like negative publicity. Up in Smoke kind of was like starting that. In fact, the advertising line was, don't go straight to this movie.
Cheech and Chong's Up in Smoke. Don't go straight to see this movie.
I was watching the documentary. There was a point in it where, and this is where you guys need to help me, like what's real and what isn't, where it was a little uncomfortable when you guys were talking about the films that you were in and who directed.
On the other movies, I would write. Cheech would go on vacation. Howard would make the deal, and then we'd come in and shoot. But this time, Cheech wanted to be involved in everything. And he didn't want me to direct. Tom Alvison was the editor. I said, okay, Tom, you direct. You'll go down as a director. I don't care. But I'll actually be the director.
So, Tommy, you directed the films.
Wrote
and directed them.
And directed.
With me, wrote the films.
But you didn't get Cheech the director credit.
I didn't want director credit.
We both directed. See, back in the day, there was rules, unwritten rules. You know, you don't have two directors until the Coen brothers came in, you know. And it's all about the old way of doing the money, you see. Because if you're a director, you're getting paid.
So if we were to go back in time to kind of, you know, recredit the films, would it be directed by Cheech and Chong?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably would be.
Yeah.
But, yeah. I mean, Cheech, did you ever get annoyed that...
No, not at that point, no. It's just, you know, when I wanted to kind of go in a slightly different direction or do something, and then that's where the division came.
Because in the documentary, it seemed like that was a tense moment between you two.
Well, you always were the director. It wasn't
You got to earn it. You can't just say, oh, because I was there with the other guy that directed, I should be a director.
See, that's a lie.
That's a lie?
Yeah, well, of course it's a lie. I directed just as much as you did in the movies.
Oh, it is a tense moment.
It's still a tense moment.
Well, we broke up after that. Okay, yeah. you go, I go mine, and that was it. And we were broken up for 20 years.
No.
And then we came back together for another 20 years, it seemed like. We didn't make movies or make records, but we were on the road.
Yeah. Now, you're publicizing the film, Cheech and Chong's last movie. I mean, should we take that literally? Is this the last time we're going to see Cheech and Chong together?
Yeah, you never know. I mean, really, you never know. If something comes up and we like it, you might see a Cheech and Chong's last movie.
Last movie?
Yeah.
That's Cheech Marin and Tommy Chong. They're the subjects of the new documentary, Cheech and Chong's Last Movie. It's receiving a limited release on, of course, you guessed it, 420. Gentlemen, thank you for coming in.
Our pleasure.
Are we on? Come on, let's go get high.
Up in Smoke. That's where I want to be.
This is NPR News.
A new podcast uses folktales to explore the richness of Sudan's culture and history at a time when the country is mired in a devastating civil war.
When you hear the music
read the literature, taste the food of a people, you come closer to them.
I'm Elsa Chang, Folktales from Sudan, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story, plus the day's news from 3 until 6:30 today on WPR.
This is WPR News.
Good morning. Happy to have you here with us on this Friday for Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:29 with news starting in just seconds.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A suspect is in custody after a mass shooting at Florida State University in Tallahassee yesterday. Officials say two people were killed and six others were wounded. They say the 20-year-old suspect is a student there and the son of a sheriff's deputy. Student Andre Perez says his classroom was around the corner from where it happened.
A warning just went out that there was an active threat on campus. Immediately, myself and my fellow classmates shut off the lights, barricaded the door, hid in our corners. Myself and many others, of course, started immediately texting our families, our friends.
President Trump met yesterday at the White House with Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, the first European leader to meet with Trump since he announced tariffs on most foreign products. Trump said he's 100% certain that he will be able to make a deal with her. NPR's Deepa Shivram has more on the story.
There's not really a sense of what the deal they're talking about will actually look like, the details of it. But, you know, as a reminder, after the initial tariffs were announced, Trump then put a 90-day pause on most of them. So where things stand right now is that all countries except China are facing a flat 10% tariff. China, meanwhile, is still sitting at a tariff of over 145%. And now Trump says that other countries want to make deals with the U.S., but he's also said that it's the U.S. that's going to set the deal.
This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:31. I'm Alex Crow. Wisconsin legislators want to revive a pre-kindergarten learning program for the state's poorest families. The bipartisan bill would establish a two-year pilot program to offer kindergarten readiness opportunities at child care centers. The services would be offered to low-income families. Wisconsin had a similar pilot program in place in 2020. It was administered by Utah-based Waterford Upstart. Kim Fisher is the spokesperson for that company. She says 92% of children who use the materials are able to read at grade level. That's compared to a national average of just 65%.
That is our primary focus, is making sure that children get that foundation of learning how to read.
If approved, the program would be paid for with a $1 million grant over the next 2 years. Northland College's board has hired an appraiser as it seeks to sell the Ashland campus and other retail estate. As Danielle Kading reports, the college will close at the end of the academic year.
The 130-acre campus is made up of 19 buildings. The Northland Board of Trustees says it's also tasked staff with collecting an inventory of art, furniture, equipment, and other items to donate, recycle, or sell. Democratic State Representative Angela Stroud used to teach at Northland. Now Stroud says the governor's office has asked the board to convene a task force on what comes next for the campus.
By convening a group of experts and developing a feasibility study, we could potentially come up with all kinds of novel ideas for how these buildings on this campus could be utilized.
The chair of Northland's board didn't immediately return a request for comment. Northland's interim president, Barb Lundberg, said it will be some time before the board can address the future of its property and other holdings. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
In weather, the eastern half of the state seeing rain and thunderstorms right now. Thunderstorms particularly in southeastern Wisconsin. Eventually highs in the 50s and 60s across the state today. That rain will clear overnight. Low temperatures, though, dropping all the way down into the 30s and 40s. A mix of sunshine and clouds expected tomorrow. It'll be a bit cooler than today, though, with highs in the 40s and 50s. More news available at WPR.org. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Since the Trump administration took office, it has cut billions of dollars in global health programs. That's everything from vaccines to food assistance to treat malnutrition. Throughout all this, the administration has said that life-saving medications for people with HIV would, however, continue to flow. But on the ground, we're hearing a very different story. NPR's Gabriela Emanuel joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Gabriela, you've just returned from Zambia to find out more about what's going on. Why'd you choose Zambia?
So I chose Zambia because, like many countries in Africa, it was very hard hit by the HIV/AIDS epidemic, which peaked in the mid-90s. And the U.S. has played a pivotal role in controlling the epidemic, including paying for HIV medication. This has been a bipartisan 20-plus year effort, and it's been very effective. New infections have dropped by almost 40% in the last 15 years. Life expectancy has rebounded. So I wanted to see if those HIV drugs are, as the administration says, still accessible.
And are they still accessible?
Well, a lot of people can no longer get their HIV meds, and now they're getting sick. For example, I went to one neighborhood in Zambia's Copper Belt.
Just on the edge of town, there's a U.S.-funded HIV clinic next to a church. And the clinic, it's totally locked up.
Now it's closed.
Reverend Billions Chandwe tells me that it was abruptly shut down in January when the U.S. issued a stop work order. He lets me peek in.
Did they take out the furniture? And they cut the electricity?
Yes.
Okay.
A few months ago, this clinic served thousands of HIV patients. Across the country, there are dozens and dozens of clinics like this one, U.S.-funded, now closed. I walk into the neighborhood and meet many of the clinic's former patients. One is 42-year-old Mary Mayongana. Mary is tall but incredibly skinny. And when I first meet her, she's at home, sitting on the cement floor, her head resting against the brick wall. In the 2.5 months since the clinic shut, she hasn't been able to find a steady supply of her daily HIV meds.
So there are times when I'll go 2 weeks without taking my medication.
Sometimes neighbors give her a few HIV pills. Mary tries to stretch the supply.
So I'll skip 2 days and then take a tablet, skip 2 days and take a tablet.
It's a risky approach since it breeds drug-resistant HIV, but Mary says it's all she can think to do. Without her meds, she's developed classic signs of the virus coming back: weakness, fatigue, fevers, sweats, and a terrible itchy rash.
My skin on my arms is peeling. I've got open wounds. I've got an open wound on my leg.
She's heard there are still HIV drugs at Zambian government clinics, but the closest one is a 45-minute walk, and Mary struggles to even stand.
I spend a lot of time thinking about what is likely to become of me.
Mary is far from alone. Oswald Sindaza oversees a free HIV clinic. He used to have a staff of 21, but after the U.S. cut foreign aid, they were all laid off.
We have over 6,400 clients, and I'm just alone.
6,000 patients for one doctor?
Yes.
And these are all HIV-positive patients?
These are HIV-positive clients. So the clinics are really overwhelmed. I'm moving like a headless chicken.
He says he knows a lot of HIV patients are without their meds, and the virus is rebounding.
Wow, Gabriela, I mean, I'm listening to that. And clearly these life-saving medications are not getting to where they need to be. And the Trump administration is saying they continue. So where's the disconnect here?
So the HIV meds are part of this broader system, a complex supply chain and distribution method. And when the U.S. started pulling contracts and shutting down funding, that whole system just collapsed in a lot of places. And I should note, the U.S. State Department did not respond to my request for comment.
So then who fills the gap here? Does it now fall to the country's Ministry of Health?
Yes, in many cases it does. And I reached out to the Zambian Ministry of Health and they declined to discuss the U.S. aid cuts with me. But in the country, there is this recognition that they were too dependent on aid. Yet at the same time, there is also a lot of outrage that this shutdown happened with absolutely no warning.
NPR's Gabriella Emanuel. Thank you, Gabriella.
Thank you.
The Trump administration is shutting down an offshore wind project that was under construction near Long Island. The multi-billion dollar project would have supplied more than 500,000 homes with power. Here's NPR's Julia Simon.
The project is called Empire Wind One. And this week, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum sent a memo calling for a halt to the project. Yesterday, Equinor, which operates the project, announced it's suspending all construction. Donald Trump is a longtime critic of wind energy. One of his first actions back in the White House was to issue a moratorium halting new offshore wind projects. But this action, halting a project that already had permits and already broke ground, is an escalation, says Robert Freudenberg at the New York Energy Nonprofit Regional Plan Association.
Yeah, I'd say this really is next level offshore wind aggression.
In his memo to the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, Burgum wrote that the project's approval was, quote, rushed through by the Biden administration. But there's no evidence to suggest it was rushed, says Matthew Eisenson at Columbia University.
BOEM spent 2.5 years conducting an environmental review. The final product of that environmental review is over 3,000 pages long, and it's very thorough. You know, this rationale is very suspect.
The Department of Interior did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Trump has often said, without evidence, that the offshore wind industry kills whales. On Monday, the Government Accountability Office issued a report investigating offshore wind. It finds that the offshore wind industry poses little risk to whales. About 10% of U.S. energy comes from wind. That number was slated to grow with new offshore wind projects in states like Massachusetts and Virginia. But Freudenberg says those projects could be at risk, as are other projects that already have federal permitting.
It should send alarm bells, not just to the offshore wind industry, but to industries beyond offshore wind, that the federal government could choose to stop projects that had been approved and are underway at their whim.
He says now any industry that requires federal permits should wonder, will the U.S. federal government be true to its word? Julia Simon, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It's 8:42 on this Friday. Got about 18 minutes left before news coming up at 9 o'clock. And of course, because it's a Friday, Wisconsin Life is coming up before that. Today, we're going to hear a story about connecting with nature as spring emerges. Plus, we're going to hear a story about churches that make decorative chocolate Easter eggs and a congregation that says that it's become a major fundraiser. That's all ahead.
Lunchtime is always more fun with Larry.
Bill in Douglas County. Hi, Bill.
Hi, I have a funny story about keeping critters at bay. We had a mother bear and four cubs around, and they were just decimating the blueberries. And I hung a battery-operated radio and turned it to public radio. Larry, they probably heard your show. And it kept the bears away from that whole area, and I was able to pick for weeks.
The Larry Mueller Show. Weekdays from 11 to 1 on WPR News.
Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 2025 Milwaukee Film Festival, April 24th through May 8th. 2 weeks of screenings, events, and visiting artists. Tickets at mkefilm.org.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, Carthage is expanding its offering of summer camps and clinics for K-12 students. They range in length from 1 to 5 days and include commuter or residential options. More info at carthage.edu.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. At 8:44, here's what's happening in news. Two people were killed and at least six others wounded yesterday when a gunman opened fire at Florida State University. Police said a 20-year-old suspect was shot and taken into custody. Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen has met with Kilmar Garcia, the man who was deported from Maryland to El Salvador. The Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen is in El Salvador right now trying to facilitate his return. The U.S. Supreme Court has called on the Trump administration to facilitate that return. And U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says the U.S. may, quote, move on from trying to secure a Russia-Ukraine peace deal if there's no progress made in the next few days. This is Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
It's Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Sarah Hopeful with a story about connecting with nature as spring emerges.
As winter fades and Wisconsin begins to thaw, the changing season brings renewal, not only to the land, but also to the human spirit. Writer Ron Weber explores how the arrival of spring awakens long-forgotten memories and gives us a chance to rediscover the sense of wonder that often lies dormant within us.
We look forward to it with the anticipation of a child waiting for a midnight visit from Santa. Winter has been long, and though we may have enjoyed all the sledding, skating, ice fishing, and snowmobiling, we are more than ready for its coming. As the snow and ice recede under a sun whose zenith climbs minutely higher with each passing day, we ready ourselves for the season of rebirth. Spring comes with many sights, sounds, and scents, emerging on a once frozen landscape, awakening feelings and memories, some of which we may have thought long forgotten. For me, the first true sign of spring is the sound of water on the move, whether it be dripping off the big maple in our front yard, flowing down our driveway, or rushing through the stream out back towards Soft Maple Creek, the Chippewa River, and eventually the sea. That sound can be heard both
Service in Milwaukee Sullivan has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for southern Milwaukee County in southeastern Wisconsin, Racine County in southeastern Wisconsin, southeastern Waukesha County in southeastern Wisconsin until 9:15 a.m. At 8:46 a.m., severe thunderstorms were located along a line extending from Muskego to Eagle Lake, moving east at 70 miles an hour. Hazard, quarter-size hail. Source, radar indicated. Impact, damage to vehicles is expected. Locations impacted include Muskego, Franklin, North Bay, Raymond, Browns Lake, South Milwaukee, North Cape, Cudahy, Windpoint, Union Grove, Racine, Oak Creek, Eagle Lake, Elmwood Park, Franksville, Mount Pleasant, Caledonia, Wind Lake, Greendale, and Hales Corners. Other landmarks included are the following locations: Warner Botanical Gardens and General Mitchell International Airport. For your protection, move to an interior room on the lowest floor of a building.
My house. Those journeys with the sticks led to all sorts of discoveries and high adventure. An empty beer can in the ditch was fished out and upon inspection revealed a crayfish which had crawled inside. This inspired me to check other cans and eventually to enlarge the hole in the can just slightly to make it so inviting to more and larger crayfish. One year, a particularly heavy snowmelt and subsequent rains flooded a field and section of the woods behind our house. We first waded into this ephemeral wonder, but soon figured out the most adventurous way to explore it would be by canoe. And so, for the first and only time, we were sailors on the high seas. Expertly guiding our craft through the perilous trees and bushes we heretofore ran through. The snow will eventually melt, the rains will come, and water will again start its journey across the land. Ditches and creeks will swell, carrying their precious cargo seaward. Here is hoping that the young and young at heart still take the time to throw a stick into the flowing water and chase after it. Those lucky enough to do just that may get an education of sorts and find that not only does it fill their day, but their memory as well.
Ron Weber is a writer who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Sarah Hopeful.
This is WPR News.
Saturday nights on WGTD HD1 is your place for jazz, big band blues, and more. Beginning at 7 p.m., it's Saturday Night Bandstand with Mike Kehoe, followed by Tim Bell's classic big bands and John Nicholson's At the Water's Edge. Then it's rotating hosts at 11 p.m., Joe Mooney from Jazz A La Carte, Dave Overby with the Jazz Club, Matt Nicholson from Jazz After Hours, and Davey Moe of Beyond Category. Locally hosted jazz Saturday evenings, 7 p.m. to midnight on WGTD HD1.
Morning edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. In weather, it'll be mostly cloudy, at least for the rest of this morning. Some rain in the eastern portion of the state, some thunderstorms in southeastern Wisconsin this morning. High temperatures in the 50s and 70s today. That rain will clear up later on. Overnight, still clear with lows in the 30s and 40s. Cooler tomorrow with highs in the 40s and 50s. This is WPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Every president brings a personal touch to the Oval Office. Ronald Reagan brought a collection of bronze saddles and his jar of Jelly Bellies. Barack Obama introduced a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. and a bowl of apples. Donald Trump, in his second term, is bringing gold, a lot of it. So how is that changing the look and feel of the White House and the image the presidency projects? Our colleague Michelle Martin posed that question to Robin Givhan. She's a senior critic at large at the Washington Post who recently wrote about what she calls the gilding of the Oval Office.
Well, I think one of the things that most people who've seen pictures of the Oval Office might recall is that over the fireplace mantle, there has long been this large planter filled with ivy. And, you know, the story of that ivy goes back many, many, many presidencies. And that ivy has now been replaced by a series of gold objects. And the pieces that are actually on the mantle are typically used for displaying large floral arrangements, for holding desserts and tea cakes and bonbons. So they're not necessarily things that you would naturally see in an office, and they have been part of the White House collection for years.
So I take it you're not a fan.
I would say that it looks a bit cluttered. And when these pieces were first acquired by the White House, there was some concern in Congress that they reflected too much of an appreciation and an ode to the monarchy, which was not at all what the United States was about. And they also reflect an idea about wealth and power and privilege that feels very of a piece with a different time.
You know, this is always a thing, like, what is taste, right? And a lot of people would sort of say, well, taste is sort of ascribing something to being tasteful or not tasteful is inherently classist. What would you say to that?
I think that's very true. And I think that to some degree, there is an elitist point of view that would look at that, the way that he's decorated the Oval Office, and say that it looks very nouveau riche. And then there are those who could also look at it and say that it's, you know, simply an exuberant celebration of success. But I think one thing that is unnerving is so much of it seems to be situated around this idea of regalness. That is a real departure from the kind of power that the Oval Office has always projected. Part of its power, I think, has come from the fact that it didn't need all of these elements in order to convey authority, that the authority came from this idea of the people and of democracy.
Robin Givhan is Washington Post senior critic at large. Robin, thank you.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
For Easter, churches in Appalachia sell handmade chocolate eggs as fundraisers. Some churches have become famous for the treats. Reporter Zach Harrell takes us into one of their kitchens.
When Pastor John Langenstein found out 4 years ago he'd been assigned to a new church in Clarksburg, West Virginia, everyone he talked to had the same response.
Oh, you're going to the egg church. Didn't matter who I was talking to. Oh, you're going to the egg church. And I said, okay, well, that'll be interesting. And then, oh, you're not ready.
And he wasn't ready for the major chocolate egg operation at Northview United Methodist Church. Every spring, church members gather in the basement kitchen to crank out shiny chocolate eggs.
The molds are double-coated. Yep, and ready to go. We'll put filling in them. And we're doing maple nut this morning.
Serena Ashcraft is in charge today. I asked her how many eggs they usually make for Easter.
Oh my gosh, Nadine, how many do we make?
Oh, between 6,000 and 8,000.
Yeah.
That's Nadine Holt with her in the kitchen. She's in charge of mixing the fillings for those 6,000 to 8,000 eggs.
She's 84 years old.
87!
Oh my gosh, that even makes it more awesome.
Holt has been volunteering since the very first egg sale at Northview in 1997.
The people are dead now that I started with, and they just said, we're going to do Easter eggs. They said, you want to help? And I said, sure, here I am.
Northview's eggs come in six flavors: coconut, cherry nut, maple nut, peanut butter, butterfinger, and solid chocolate.
These are the same recipes we've been using for 26 years.
Pastor Langenstein says they make eggs 3 days a week starting in January, all with volunteer labor from the congregation of about 100 people. They spread melted chocolate into molds, add the filling, and box up the finished eggs for sale.
All generations coming in. Last year, our youngest person helping out with eggs was 6 years old, and our oldest was, I think you win that, Nadine, 87. But.
Northview eggs sell for $3 to $9 a piece, depending on the size. They're a big fundraiser for the church and an Eastertime delicacy in these parts. They rarely give them away. Even broken eggs sell for half price. But in the name of journalism, they let me have a taste.
Here's a Butterfinger. It tastes like a Butterfinger.
I told you.
It's peanut butter and candy corn.
Yeah.
The origin of the church-made chocolate Easter egg is kind of hazy. They appear to have first shown up in the mid-20th century in central Pennsylvania before spreading through the rest of central Appalachia. There are other churches all through West Virginia that make and sell chocolate Easter eggs, but Northview is the best known.
To my knowledge, we are the biggest. If there is a bigger, they're not advertising as well as we are.
They sell their eggs around town at beauty parlors, car dealerships, tire shops, and even the courthouse. They also ship them across the country. But for volunteers, it's less about the money.
Other than the fact that, you know, obviously it helps support the work of the church. Is it just fun? For as much work as it is and as much as a taskmaster Serena can be, we get, you know.
We laugh, we joke.
For this small congregation, community and fellowship is worth the long days on the Easter egg production line. For NPR News, I'm Zach Harrell in Clarksburg, West Virginia.
You can learn more about how the Northview Easter eggs are made on the podcast, The Daily Yonder. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Alex Crow, and that'll do it for Morning Edition on this Friday on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for spending time with us this morning. And of course, as always, thanks to John Davis for helping bring us the news. That news is on the way here on WPR.
You come to WPR News for trustworthy reporting, thought-provoking conversations, and laugh-out-loud entertainment. Thank you to the tens of thousands of donors who provide the largest source of support for WPR programs.
Support comes from the Kenosha County Aging and Disability Resource Center. Budget a little tight? The agency can help save money on prescriptions, utilities, Medicare costs, and groceries. Boost your budget. Call to see if you qualify. 262-605-6646. Free and confidential.
Your gateway to public radio is WGT.